This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When people from outside Connecticut ask me what I like so much about our state, one of the first things I tell them is, I live 5 minutes from two beautiful state forests, American Legion and Peoples. We fish there, we hike there, we swim there, and I live close by dozens more. I tell them that I spend big chunks of my summer taking in the sun at Hammonasset State Park and the Shoreliner, taking a leisurely stroll up Norfolk's Haystack Mountain. I'm one of 8 million people who visit Connecticut State Parks and Forests each year. If a place is defined in large part by its quality of life, our park and forest system helps to make this a great place to live. Today, where we live, we're going to look at the history and the future of these places. How were our 139 parks and forests established? What stories do they have to offer? We'll discuss some of the funding and preservation efforts to make sure that they're here for centuries to come. We want you to join the conversation. What's your local state park where you live? What are some of your favorites? What questions do you have about protecting our lands? Call us at 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at where we live, and we would love to hear from you as we have a conversation today about our state parks and forests. I want to welcome in Tom Tyler. He's the Director of State Parks and Public Outreach for the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the DEEP. Tom, welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Al Levere is here. He's a historian for the state parks, also working with the DEEP. Alan, thank you so much for being here as well.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Joining us down the line from Washington, D.C. is Eric Hammerling. He's Executive Director of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. Thank you, Eric.
Good morning, John.
First, I'm going to start with you, Al, just to get a little bit of historical backdrop here. And we're celebrating 100 years of state parks. So what are you doing, first of all, to celebrate? We see the signs up around. What else is happening?
Well, I think the celebration of the centennial is many faceted. It has different... One of the messages we wanted to get out first was to let people know. And so we have the signs at some of our predominant state parks, especially where the traffic would be heaviest. We have instituted a website specifically dedicated to the centennial, and we have lots of information. In fact, a fact of the day comes up every single day for the centennial year, and we have a application for the phone so folks can get out there and make sure that they are familiar with the parks, and once they're there, what they can get the information and so on and so forth. So we're getting out as many, and as you can imagine, marketing with no budget is always a challenge, but we're getting what we can, and we've done well to have some coverage with local newspapers and television.
Well, talk a little bit, Tom Tyler, about this history, and I know you can jump in here, Al. We're talking about 100 years of history. How did the state park and forest system get started?
You mentioned the interesting stories behind the creation of the park system, and that's really what's really most intriguing to me, and certainly Al can share some of those with your listeners. We are beginning the celebration or into the celebration of the centennial of Connecticut State Parks. We're really celebrating the period from September in 1913 when the State Park Commission was initially formed. Through December of 1914, when the first properties were purchased at what would later become Sherwood Island State Park in Westport, and starting there, and even a little bit before, with some of the prominent citizens and interested folks, both inside government and outside government, with important supporters, not the least of which is Eric's organization, the Forest and Park Association, real leaders from the beginning of the creation of a system of state parks and forests for the public. But as Al was saying, we've got a series of events to help celebrate that. Just a few other elements, and I certainly would initially point people to our website. If you go to the DEP's website and look for State Park Centennial, you'll see a bunch of information. But ranges from the banners, as you've mentioned, but also a number of very large projects we'll be instituting over the next over the next year or so to help celebrate the centennial.
Well, Eric Hammerling, what are the important things we should know about the history of these parks as we look back 100 years ago and see that we have this rich park system that has 139 parks and forests of various types, which we'll be talking about? What are the important things that we should really know about this history, Eric?
Well, I like to look a little bit before the 100-year anniversary and think about the start of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association back in 1895. As an organization, actually, we were started to try to found state parks and forests and protect forest lands and conserve the forests that at that time had been relatively decimated. We had only about 20% forest cover in the state, and we were inspired by national parks and national forests. We were inspired by Bushnell Park as a municipal park. And the organization at the very get-go said, we need to have these special state resources to be protected. So in 1903, we had our first state forest in Connecticut. And then in 1913, as Tom mentioned, we had our first state park. There was a lot of work by a lot of people that went into making sure those places were protected, and the stories are amazing, and I'm sure we'll talk some more about that.
Well, and we want to hear some stories. We also want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. As you listen, perhaps you can tell us about some of your favorite state parks, how you've used this park and forest system. This history, Al, I think is really important. When Eric talks about 20% forest cover, we forget that Connecticut was not a place primarily covered by trees 100-plus years ago. It was a place that had been deforested. It had been farmed. It's the reason why when we wander through the forest today, we see those beautiful stone walls. They weren't put there to just be decorations in the forest. They were put there because they divided farmlands, and then eventually the trees grew up around them. So this change is very important. We went from a place that was not forested to a place that was very forested, and the park and forest system, I think, Al, had a big part to do with it.
Very much so. And the early parks, it was very interesting. There were, as Eric alluded to, there were city parks, and city parks were a great relief for the folks who lived in the urban environment and needed a relief from those what we would call almost, well, very difficult tenement lifestyles. They had the city parks. They could walk there, which was very nice. The national parks, on the other hand, were beginning in 1872 with Yellowstone, but you had to have time and money to be able to get out there and see these vast wonders. So we had city parks and we had national parks. The state parks were a little bit late to the dance because two things had to happen. We had to have initiative to do that, and we did because our three neighboring states already had state parks.
We were behind on all this.
We're a little late to the dance on this, but I think it paid off from what I can gather and what the records indicate. It paid off because when we came in with a vengeance, and we came in a well-directed fashion, and we started to build a park system that, in fact, was the basis for what the landscape provided at the time. So one of your places, all the mountains, the high hills in western Connecticut were very much part of the early park system because there people could go and get a great view. But you had to be able to get there. And back in those days, the two means of transportation were predominantly trolley lines. And then little by little, this automobile thing that I have to tell you that they wondered if this was going to stick. Is this going to catch on? What actually do we do? These six commissioners were children of the 1870s and 1880s. Their youth was spent on horse-drawn vehicles. So in the 1890s, the horse-drawn trolleys get taken over by the electric trolleys, and slowly, that all gets taken over by the automobile. And in 1913, the same year that the parks began in Connecticut, Henry Ford introduces the assembly line, bringing individual transportation into the buying range of many, many people.
You know, and it's interesting. The more things change, I suppose they do stay the same. The way that I, as much as we talk about public transportation and the culture of the car here in Connecticut, and maybe something that needs to change, the way I've experienced so much of our parkland, our forest land, our beaches, is just through taking a drive. That's what this is good for. You can drive throughout Connecticut and just find places you might not have expected. I want to go to the phones quickly at 860-275-7266 because a lot of people want to join us. Fred's calling from Vernon. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. When I first moved to Connecticut 30 years ago, I was shocked at how little access there was to the beach, to the ocean. I spent so much time in New Jersey where the beach is extensive and very accessible. But over the years, I have really come to love Hammonasset because you're all sort of shunted there. and you are as likely to hear Spanish or Russian or Mandarin or Hindi as you are English. And it just confirms my faith that Connecticut is changing. It's still a melting pot. And it's just a very, very, you know, sort of democracy-affirming place. I really love it there.
First of all, Fred, it's one of my favorite places, not only in Connecticut, but in the world. And Tom Tyler, I think one of the stories that he tells about Hammonasset that's so important is that it really is a place where people do come together. If you picnic at one of the pavilions, you hear people speaking Russian and Spanish, and you see people playing dominoes and entire families getting together and playing salsa music and dancing, but then also enjoying big pieces of beach. A lot of people say, I've got to go to the beach in Rhode Island. And I always tell them, you don't need to go as far as Rhode Island. That's the next state away. Stay in Connecticut and go to Hammonasset. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of this park? Because it's really one of the state parks that a lot of people, not only from Connecticut, but from elsewhere, do enjoy about the state.
Absolutely. Certainly Hammonasset is our most popular state park, welcoming roughly 2 million visitors per year and hundreds of thousands of campers enjoying the campground down there. As you indicate, they really are places that welcome, you know, people from all over the state and visitors from all over. As you say, lots of different cultures and enjoying the fresh air. One thing I'd say about the interesting point you made about, you know, other states and a little comparison to a New Jersey that has just, you know, endless, you know, beautiful beaches is kind of going back to the initial history. You know, Connecticut, you know, does have we've got some beautiful stretches of sandy beach, but we have also many, many miles of non-sandy beaches. So the interesting thing to me is while it's true we don't have the endless miles of beaches that some other states have, the state of Connecticut, on behalf of its citizens, controls really all the good beaches.
And it's not just the amount of sandy beach that we have. It really is the amount of private ownership. I mean, that's part of the story of Connecticut's shoreline is there's an awful lot of private ownership. You can't just go down to the beach in Connecticut like you can in a lot of other states.
Yeah, but again, I think even, you know, very early on, and Al can talk more about Albert Turner, who was one of the really founders of the park system and did some of the initial reconnoitering of the shoreline. Hammonasset was a place that he identified very early as a place that really needed to be in public ownership. I don't know, Al, if you wanted to jump onto the Hammonasset. It's certainly one of our favorite stories.
Absolutely, yeah. And we could easily spend an hour just on Hammonasset. It is a wonderful place. You know, comprising about 1,000 acres now, we had in the very beginning, the commissioners got together. They say, okay, what do we do? How are we going to do this? How are we going to pull this together? They said, we need a field man. They hired a gentleman by the name of Albert Turner, civil engineer from Yale, who assesses the entire state. He walks the coast from Rhode Island to New York border. He walks every hilltop, every big lake, and the southern part of the lower half of every river in the state. And his cues, and what's wonderful about Mr. Turner is that he took pictures along the way. So we have pictures of what would become state parks while they were in his vision, which is really kind of exciting.
He's essentially taking a survey of what could be a great state park.
And he did. And he documented it all. And he alone, more than any other person, but almost alone, the first 30 years of the park system are his visions of what parks should be like.
Eric Hammerling, tell us a story, one of your favorite stories about the parks and forests, about maybe some of the people that made this happen.
Well, one of my favorite stories has to do with Gillette Castle State Park, which many of your listeners are very familiar with. That's a place that when the Gillette family was interested in giving it to the state or selling it to the state, the state at first was not interested in taking it, and we take for granted today that all of our state parks and forests are places that were loved from the beginning and are treated the way that we want to see them treated today. But at the time, the state had to really think about, you know, do we want to take responsibility for this unique building? Do we want to share that with the public? Do we want to be responsible for maintenance, et cetera? And in fact, the state initially said, no, we're not interested in accepting Gillette Castle. And it took, actually, this is something that I'm very thankful for my predecessors at CFPA, but they both raised money to help acquire it. And I have to admit, used a little bit of shame tactics to say to the governor, come on, this is a special place. You need to protect it for Connecticut citizens forever. So through a little bit of shame and a lot of money and a lot of goodwill, that special place that we all enjoy today was protected.
We don't know anything about shame tactics here at Public Radio. We're, of course, in the middle of a fundraiser right now. We'll be hearing more about that in a bit. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with Eric Hammerling, Executive Director of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association, who joins us today from NPR in D.C. Al Levere is here. He's from the DEEP. He's a historian. Tom Tyler's also here from the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Director of State Parks and Public Outreach. We want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Tell us about your favorite state parks and forests, the places in Connecticut that are so special that have been protected. Tell us some of your stories. 860-275-7266. When we come back, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about Connecticut's parks and forests. We've been looking back at some of the history in our state. We want to look at what lies ahead as well. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266 as the park and forest system in Connecticut celebrates its 100th anniversary. Let's go to the phones. Barbara is in Rocky Hill. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am definitely interested in the Moosup Trail. I like off the grid, the places that you might not find that unless you're really with through that lovely long list of state parks. So can you give me more details about Moosup?
About Moosup? What can we tell her about Moosup, Tom?
It's a beautiful trail. I understand, to be perfectly honest with you, I haven't traipsed it myself. We have a little bit of information on our website, and we're happy to try and get you more information or in touch with local folks who can talk more about potential trailheads. But it certainly raises the issue that across the system there are as John indicated earlier, there's such a range of things, whether it's the enjoying the beach on a summer day to enjoying the opportunity for cross-country skiing, there is just or things like the Moosup Trail or the Airline Trail or just a number of paths through the woods that exist across the state. We really have such an array of activities for folks.
Eric, you have any information on Moosup for her at all?
That's not one of the trails that I've spent time on, but of course, many of the state parks have Blue Blaze hiking trails maintained by CFPA volunteers that run through them, and they're wonderful resources. If you want to explore the woods, the safest way to do that is on a trail, a well-marked trail, and obviously it takes you to those amazing vantage points to see the sights, and also will help to get you back to your car.
And I will also say we were talking about places where you can get good views. In the park that I go to, People's State Forest, there are still places where you can go to an overlook and look out over the landscape and not see any houses, not see any cell towers, not see anything other than rolling hills in the summertime. We're going to get some more phone calls in just a moment. Eric, how are the parks doing from your perspective in terms of funding and maintenance? Do you think that we are investing in our state parks the way we should be? Al made a little joke on the air before. It's hard to market the parks with a zero budget out here for this centennial that we have. How do you think they're doing, Eric?
Well, let me mention two quick things. One on the centennial, I do want to make sure to recognize Pam Adams and the volunteers who've been working on the centennial effort. They really, the state has not been able to allocate money specifically for the centennial, and those wonderful signs that you see at many of the parks, that was the result of private money being raised, and many of the events are also because of the work by volunteers that have been done for the parks. And I think that's symbolic in a way of the fact that the state is really not investing in our state park system the way it needs to. Right now, there's about $12 million that it takes to run the 107 state parks. And unfortunately, it takes a lot of people to maintain those parks. Right now, There's fewer than 80 field staff who are responsible for maintaining those 107 state parks. And recommendations have been made in the past by an in-depth infrastructure study that was done about 10 years ago that said, really, you need to have more than 200 people to adequately maintain the parks. And that study was done at a time when there were six fewer parks than we have today. So I think the state is really underinvesting in the parks. And, you know, fortunately, and I'm glad to know that Mary Mashinsky is going to be on the show, I think some of the recommendations from the Program Review and Investigations Committee will be helpful and help to restore some funding to the parks that they hopefully will be able to retain far into the future.
And we are going to be talking a bit more about the funding structure for our state parks moving forward in a little bit on our program. We're going to take some of your phone calls, though. First, Margaret's calling from Roxbury. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for this wonderful show.
Thank you.
The parks and the public open spaces are just wonderful here in Connecticut. I'm part of a small group. Eric is also a member, called the State Lands Working Group. And we're hoping, we have gradually discovered that very few of our public lands and parks and beautiful places have secure deed protection. They can be proposed or taken over for other uses. And Eric is very articulate, and he can explain more, but we're hoping this legislative session to pass some kind of some legislation that will increase the protections so these parks will remain for the public pretty much as close as one can come to permanently. And I thank the DEP who's been working with us, but we still have a ways to go.
Margaret, thank you very much for your phone call. Eric, you want to pick up on that?
Sure. When the state of Connecticut gives a grant to a land trust, for example, to protect a piece of property, they insist that that land trust puts a conservation easement on it to protect it in perpetuity. But when the state either acquires land or at times is donated land, it doesn't use that same practice itself, which means that there's nothing on the land records that legally protects the property. And I think we all assume, especially if we use or live near a state park or forest, that means if it's a state park or forest, it will be there forever. But unless there's something legally on the land records that protects it, it's very vulnerable to a process that is used by the legislature every year. It's called the conveyance bill process. And it allows the legislature to give away, to trade, or to sell state land. Most people don't realize that process even exists, but it seems to be being used a bit more than any of us would like to see. And we want to see those state lands protected. So as Margaret said, one of the things that we feel is critical is to make sure that the commissioner of DEEP and the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture, for example, have the ability to put a conservation restriction on state land that at the very least will make clear what the intended uses are supposed to be for that that piece of land. Right now, there's nothing.
When we come back later on in our program, we talk with State Representative Mary Mashinsky. We may be talking a bit more about some of the issues that could rise to the state legislature, including protection of state lands. Mary Ann's in Fairfield. Hi, Mary Ann. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
I want to say first off that the state parks are the most pleasant interaction I have with the state of Connecticut. Most other times it's like DMV or something like that. But my main question is, how are you prioritizing what land to acquire? And are you working with the land trusts and at all?
Tom Tyler, talk about that, please.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, thank you for the compliment of your interactions with DEP, though we love our friends at DMV as well. They're a lot of good folks. But
no, nobody really goes to the DMV with a picnic and some s'mores, right. At the end
that's
of the
right.
day. But
that's
please,
right.
continue.
So certainly the focus on land acquisition, throughout the history and today has obviously taken, obviously a great deal of resources, but also focus in planning about where the priority landscapes are to preserve, and they range from supporting outdoor recreation to critical habitats to those historic features or facilities we all want to protect. So there's a range of different places and types of places that we're focusing on. And certainly working with land trusts and other folks out there, land conservation organizations is an absolute critical piece of that. The state has two significant programs where we acquire property for public enjoyment or participate in the acquisition. One is the Recreation and Natural Heritage Trust Program, where we purchase lands to be held in the name of the state as state parks or state forests, wildlife management areas, other facilities. But the other significant one you may be aware of is a grant program where we provide resources to land trust and others for them to acquire property. So that's a critically important part of the program.
And we just have a minute before our break. I'm just wondering if you can quickly address what we were talking about before. If indeed the state is able to protect these lands in perpetuity, the way in which the state might acquire them from land trust would be quite a bit different than if they weren't protected moving forward, to the earlier caller's point. So can you assure land trust that you're working with that indeed, if we purchase these lands for the state, that they are going to be protected forever? We just have a little bit of time, but go ahead.
That's certainly an important issue to touch on. And an awful lot of folks are looking at it, as Eric and others who know who've spent time on this issue, delves very quickly into a lot of legal issues about acquiring property and how they are preserved, and an awful lot of smart people are working on that to try and find ways to bring that permanent protection to state-owned lands as well.
We're talking with Tom Tyler and Alivier from the DEEP. I want to thank Eric Hammerling, who's Executive Director of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association, who joined us from D.C. today. Thank you so much, Eric.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more about legislation to protect our state parks and taking more of your calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We will recap Governor Daniel Malloy's State of the State address, talk about some of the proposals he laid out surrounding the state budget, education, and the minimum wage. As always, we're joined by Colin McEnroe and a panel of reporters. You can join the conversation as well on WNPR.org. Today on the program, we're talking about our state forests and parks. They're celebrating their 100-year anniversary, and we're taking a lot of your phone calls. Joining us from the DEEP is Tom Tyler and Al Levere. In just a moment, we'll be hearing from Representative Mary Mashinsky talking about legislation to protect the parks. But first, let's go to some phone calls. People want to join us. George is calling from Ellington. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I'm working with the Ellington Conservation Commission to try and provide access to our state parks. Our local park in Ellington is Snifsit State Forest, and our local Board of Selectmen does not see the value of...
George, I think that what you have is your radio on in the background, and I can hear ourselves talking back there. So I apologize. Maybe we can reestablish your line. I want to go quickly to Mary Mashinsky, who's state representative for the 85th Assembly District, co-chair of the Programs Review and Investigations Committee that conducted this review of state park funding. Representative, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
So talk about this review. What is it you're looking at for the state parks? I'm sorry, and I apologize. I think I've hit the wrong button again. We're having some technical difficulties. Go ahead and restart your answer to me, if you don't mind, Mary.
Sure. Good morning, and thanks for inviting me to be on your show. Our committee looked at the adequacy of funding to support the parks since they are 100 years old this year, and we want them to last another 100 years at least. So. Last June, we voted to investigate the park system. And what we found is that the level of budget expenditures for this past year is comparable to 2006. So the system has suffered some losses. And the system is heavily reliant on the general fund, and so there's no incentive to focus on generating revenues right inside the park system, as is true in many other states. So we're one of the few that supports our parks from the general fund, and the national trend is in the other direction, have more revenue raising in the parks. Our staffing levels are down, and we think we need another 12 personnel at the park system.
I just want to interrupt. Eric Hammerling was talking about the all-time low about personnel. Obviously, we need more people running these parks. We've seen times at which some of the parks have been shut down. So there's this kind of catch-22. If you want to have the state parks support themselves as opposed to paying for them out of the general fund, what that means is you've got to have state parks that can generate a certain amount of revenue. But I could see where some state parks are going to generate a lot more revenue, we talked about Hammonasset, than others. So do we have a system where maybe some state parks survive and others don't survive because of their ability or not to raise funds?
No, our recommendation is that we allow the parks to keep 25 to 50% of the revenues. And you're right, certain parks, especially the beach parks, will raise more revenues, and that can be distributed to the lesser-known parks. But right now there is no incentive for any of the park units to generate revenue because they don't get to keep a portion of it. And we think that should be reversed, and there should be an allotment to the Parks Division as long as they demonstrate park performance using results-based accountability. And by that we mean they analyze themselves and they measure three key areas. They measure attendance, safety, and customer satisfaction, and they report that annually to the Parks Division and to the whole state of Connecticut on the website. And then we believe they should be allowed to keep a portion of the revenues they raise. In the past, they up to a third of their revenue of their expenditures came out of revenue they generated themselves. But right now, it's all general fund, and that doesn't incentivize them to be creative in revenue raising. One of the new ways they can raise revenues here and in other states is renting of cabins. And they're very popular with the public. There's a waiting list to get into the cabins, and you can put a portion of that back into the park system.
You had one more example of how they can raise revenue?
Well, there are some unusual ones. Swimming areas are some, and even some states use golf courses that they have acquired and attached to a park. That's a more unusual one, but it does generate revenue for the system.
There's a few people who want to join us talking about their local state parks. So let's go to Sophia in Eastford. Hi, Sophia. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to highlight a smaller park in Connecticut. It's a little bit different from our Hammonasset and our Gillette Stadium. It's actually not a state park, but a state forest. The Goodwin State Forest in Hampton is really just a hidden gem in northeastern Connecticut. And they have great programs for both kids and adults. And the trails that they have are really well maintained. It's just a beautiful place. And it's a little bit off the beaten track. It's a little bit smaller than some of the other larger places that you've already mentioned. But it's definitely worth mentioning. And I encourage other people to come and visit.
Excellent. No, it's good to hear. I've not been to Goodwin State Park. I also like your idea of getting the revenue stream of Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. That would help to fund our state parks for a while. Let's go to Cyril and Seymour. Hi, Cyril. Go ahead.
Hi, John. I'm from Seymour. I want to talk about there's 322 acres of it is now part of the state forest. A group in Seymour was called Seva Seymour. Fought the developers who wanted to develop that land. It used to be water company land. Mm-hmm. At that time, it was owned by Birmingham Utilities. To cut a long story short, finally, we got the help of Attorney General Blumenthal, and we were at that point against Toll Brothers.
And Toll Brothers, of course, is the big housing developer, and they develop housing units all across the country.
Yes, and so think of a small group up against Toll Brothers, right? So they took what happened was then we got the help of now Senator Blumenthal. He came to our help. he challenged all the cases. It went up to the court in Superior Court in Milford, and Judge Nadeau ruled on July 20th, 2001, that the state had the right to purchase it, not Toll Brothers. Okay, so then Toll Brothers. It took almost three days of hearing.
Yes.
And then it went to this. They tried to challenge it to this. What do you call it, the appellate court or the superior court? I mean, Supreme Court. But well, they left it alone.
Well, where does it stand right now, Cyril? Quickly, if you don't mind.
It's a state forest. But what I want to say is, without Mr. Blumenthal's help, it would never have happened. There are big articles on it in the Waterbury Republican and Connecticut Post.
Well,
without his help. And I want to make sure that people know that.
Well, and thank you very much, Cyril, for that. What else can you tell us about this land in Seymour, Tom? Seymour State Park.
You know, I'm not familiar with the background back into the early 2000s about the acquisition, but certainly there was an awful lot of water company land that was determined to be excess to the needs of the water company that that the department invested a really significant amount of taxpayer resources in acquiring both fee ownership of a lot of water company land, but also conservation and public access easements across other swaths of it. But this certainly sounds like a story that gets repeated in an awful lot of places around the state where really an important local slug of forest pristine land is threatened by development, and local folks come together and work with state officials to make sure it gets preserved for the future.
Mayor Mushinski, one of the things we talked about in an earlier segment was legislation that that folks like Eric Hammerling, who we had on before, are looking at to make sure that lands that are under state control, state forests or parks, are actually protected in perpetuity. There's a little concern amongst some that the state might have the ability to use these lands for other purposes. Have you seen legislation like this, and would you be supportive of legislation like that?
I absolutely would be supportive. I vehemently objected when the department tried to swap out a piece of land along the Connecticut River and stood up and debated it and tried to kill it, but it passed anyway. Since then, the project, the development project, fell apart.
This is the infamous Haddam land swap that you're talking about?
The infamous Haddam land swap, yes. And my feeling is that if well-meaning citizens donate a piece of land to the state, they believe in their heart that it will be forever protected. And that's the reason why they donated it. If they ever knew it could be traded away, I think they would think twice about donating it to the state. So I think for the credibility of the state, once the land is protected, we really have to keep it protected.
And it's tricky
to write the language, that's for sure.
Well, sure.
I do support the bill.
And that's what I was talking about with you, Tom, earlier, is the negotiations with landowners, I think, turns entirely different if the state says, you know, the land that you're giving, whether through a land trust or a private donor, if that's going to the to the state park and forest system in perpetuity, it's a much different conversation than if they feel as though the state might turn around and sell it for some other sort of purposes.
Yeah, and that's certainly an interesting distinction you raise there about where someone is looking to donate a piece of property, you know, really with the goal of it being public in perpetuity. And in that instance, it can and does, it is preserved in perpetuity because there is the ability with the donor to permanently restrict it. It's the legal issue where the state is paying fair market value for a piece of property, where the legal issues come into play with our inability under current law to put conservation easements on it out into the future. So it really is kind of a nuanced legal issue that, as Mary indicated, it's tricky to write. But there's a lot of folks of goodwill and a single focus to try and get that accomplished this year.
We got a tweet from Lynn who says Goodwin State Forest and Conservation Education Center has become a gem due to volunteers raising dollars. A lot of people like Goodwin State Forest today. Marty's in East Hampton. Go ahead, Marty.
Good morning, Marty Podscotch from East Hampton. I'm presently writing a book about the Civilian Conservation Corps camps of Connecticut, and I'd like to put in a word of praise for the 9 years that they worked in building up our state forests and our state parks. And there's so many great guys that are still alive. They're 89 to 101 years old, and I've been gathering the stories. And I just don't want these guys to be forgotten.
Well, I'd like Al to actually jump in because we just have a few minutes left, but this Conservation Corps is an amazing story, Al.
Hugely amazing, and part of the fundamental infrastructure of the parks as we know them today. Thank you, Marty, for calling in. And with your help in my research on this, I think that we would not have the park system as we know it today without the help of the Civilian Conservation Corps. We go roaring through the 1920s. Money is good. We're able to pick up lands that we want, that we have Mr. Turner had seen. We are able to purchase those. We're building amenities on them. And then there's the big crash at the end of 1929. Park still has plans, but now we have no staff. And just the timing is so wonderful. Roosevelt, with such foresight, here come the CCCs, and these guys create the roads, the dams, the bridges, the pavilions that we take for granted in the state of Connecticut and in the parks and forests today. And as Marty knows firsthand from interviewing so many of these veterans, these guys are the ones who made it work. Some texts that I read said say 9 or 10 years that these folks were active in Connecticut, they moved the state parks forward with the work that they did by a half a century.
Now, Bernie in East Hampton, you just have a few seconds, but I'm going to give you the last word here today. Bernie, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am.
You just have a few seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. I want to encourage my legal representatives to fund the parks further. Just like the gentleman said, we have wonderful parks. But again, we have no staff, and the good work of the CCC is going to go down the tubes. And another thing that I'd like to mention is that the people who are living on the edge, not the country club set, it's those people that are speaking Italian and Russian and Spanish. The great diversity that go to places like Hammonasset. Go because it's affordable.
Because it's affordable, because it's beautiful. And Bernie, thank you so much. It's another call out to people like Mary Mashinsky, who joined us on the phone today to fund our state parks. Mary Mashinsky represents the 85th Assembly District. Thank you for joining us. Thanks also to Al Levere and Tom Tyler from the DEEP. Thank you both so much for coming in today and talking about our state parks and forests. Happy 100th anniversary.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
You can always continue the conversation online at WNPR.org.